You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
John Lanchester's latest book, Capital, is a sweeping social novel set in London at the height of the financial crisis. The story traces the lives of the residents of Pepys Road, whose property values have skyrocketed. A wealthy banker and his wife, an aging widow and her graffiti artist grandson, Pakistani shop owners, and a Senegalese soccer star. Woven in with their stories are glimpses into the lives of the contractor, nanny, and the meter maid who work on the street. Mr. Lanchester is the author of three novels, a memoir, and IOU, a work of nonfiction about the financial crisis. He's a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books and The New Yorker, and his new novel is published by Norton. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
Thank you very much, Alan.
Now, you published IOU, Why Everyone Owes Everyone and No One Can Pay in 2010, and I'm assuming that this novel grew out of that book, or did that book grow out of your thinking about this novel?
Yeah, no, it's the second way around. I started writing this book in late 2005, 2006, and strongly felt that a bust was coming. And the book has a bust in its shape, in that we know something's coming that the characters don't know, and I felt that was very important. But while I was writing, this real-world implosion happened, and it was so much bigger and so more systemic and, you know, all-encompassing, really, at a global level, that when I finished a draft of the novel, I did what I always do. I stuck it in a drawer for a few months and did what I never do and used the time constructively to write the non-fiction account.
Well, I've always wondered what happens when a writer does a lot of research for a work of fiction and uses some of it. You can't use all of it. In fact, a book that has too much research in it usually is not a good novel. What do you do with all of that knowledge?
Well, I think you nailed it, Leonard. I think a lot of people use it, and I think that often turns novels astray. I think part of the problems with research, I'm wary of too much structured research because you do end up using it. And if you go to Mumbai or Peoria, your character, or Hoboken, you know, somewhere unimaginable, your characters end up going to Mumbai, Peoria, and Hoboken, even if in fact they have absolutely no business being there.
Mm-hmm. We do have listeners in Hoboken.
Okay, so I was just kidding.
We love Hoboken.
No, but you know that thing of I know if I went to Hoboken, I'd end up using it in a book. Even if it didn't belong. And by the time I finished the draft of the novel, I knew a lot about what had happened in the banking world. And I felt that I had to be careful about that research. And so part of the reason I wrote the nonfiction thing was to effectively quarantine it so that I didn't have characters, you know, sitting around. Remind me, Nigel, what actually is the definition of a collateralized debt obligation? You know, I'm glad you asked me that question. And, you know, the reader's out cold and wakes up 8 hours later when the alarm clock goes off.
You include a lot about the setting, a fictional London street called Pepys Road, named after Samuel Pepys?
Yes.
In your mind?
In my mind, and it was meant to be a sort of subtle gesture to the four people in the world who know and care, that Pepys, Samuel Pepys retired from the Admiralty, he moved to a sleepy village several miles outside London called Clapham, and it was meant to, you know, be a nudge and a wink in that direction. And in fact, it turns out, and I was very confident because nothing is named after writers in London. Everything is named after deadbeat aristocrats who never did anything. And I was really confident that there wouldn't be a Pepys Road. And unfortunately, in fact, there are two, but they're not the ones in the book. They're in far-flung parts of the capital.
Well, this is a street that New Yorkers can relate to because it is a street that is in an area that's being gentrified.
Yes, and that's one of the things you know, that's had a very profound impact on London. Not only London, I think here too, you have that thing that the stage set looks the same, the buildings look the same, the infrastructure looks the same, but in fact it's inhabited by a completely different cast of people, that the the indigenous population that would have been there have just got effectively driven out, pushed out by the force of money. And that's had a very profound impact on all sorts of bits of you know, the city here and there. And it's one of the things I was very interested in, that, you know, as it looks the same place, but in some quite strong sense, it's actually not the same place.
New York is an expensive place to live, but London makes New York seem like a bargain. Did the cost of living rise rapidly there during the boom years of the early 2000s?
Insanely rapidly. And I think part of the reason for that is because, you know, like Manhattan, where we are, where the finance is, and the pay levels are so astronomic. And also we have tax policies that benefit very, very rich foreign people who don't pay UK tax. There's a thing called domicile, and it's basically a magnet for the international super wealthy. So it means we have a lot of people in London who effectively don't care what anything costs, ever. They never have to think about it. And that has had a tremendous impact on everyone in the city.
And those tax laws were enacted to attract people who would bring money to England. Also, London is the capital of England, unlike New York. So others will be attracted there as well.
Yes, I think you know, the governments never actually because it's a very hard policy to defend. You know, a tax regime that benefits super wealthy foreign nationals and not your own citizens. So governments never
come
clean about
it. In this country, we only try to benefit our own wealthy.
Our own super wealthy. No, we have things like that too. So you can never get the rationale's never really spent out. Apparently it started with Greek shipping magnates. And the thought was that these tycoons, not very keen on paying tax at the best of times, they'd come and live in London and they would spend, and that the spending money would go into the local economy. And then it was Arab oil money, and now it's Russian oligarchs.
And that has changed a lot, because I remember when the Beatles and other rock stars were leaving England because they didn't want to pay the high taxes.
Yeah, and wrote that wonderful song, Taxman. But the marginal tax rates there were something like 95% on the top bit of income. And that has changed, but the sort of, you know, There has been a change in the texture of life in the city caused by that thing about, you know, the income distribution skewed towards not the 1% or even the 0.1, but it really is the 0.01.
But you tell the story through people through the full range of the economy, because even in the wealthiest areas, the gentrified areas, there are still contractors and shop owners and the like.
Yes, apparently the term in sociology is crunchy. It's still socially crunchy. You have all these different layers. And that's part of what makes city life interesting. It's part of why what's unfortunate if you have that kind of money bomb, you know, radiating on a city is the risk is that everyone will gradually turn into Zurich. It's sort of, you know, clean and sanitized and everyone works in finance. And, we haven't got there yet in London.
Although the residents of the street keep finding postcards on their doorsteps that say, "We want what you have." Do they know where these cards are coming from, and do they grasp the full meaning of them?
They don't know. I mean, the sort of unifying thing in the book that brings the various stories and characters and narratives together is this thing of these mysterious cards saying, "We want what you have." And it's sort of clearer to me now in a way than it was when I was writing the book that most of the characters make the same mistake, that they think in terms of what they have as being things with, you know, a pound sign or a dollar sign. They're thinking in terms of capital in the financial sense. And I think, you know, they're tending to make the mistake that they're ignoring other sources of capital, emotional, familial, other sorts of intellectual and emotional resource. And perhaps in a way that our society, you know, Britain slightly did, we got bamboozled by money.
Well, it used to be class. Now it's money.
Well, it can be both. I mean, in theory, class is sort of soluble in money. Money dissolves class. But in practice, you know, that hasn't quite proved to be the case. Class is much less important than it was.
Although the 7-Up series showed that class still is a major determinant as to whether you'll succeed or fail.
A profound determinant. And, you know, in a year, we're celebrating the Queen's Jubilee at the moment. And, you know, it's difficult to have a society where the head of state is hereditary, and also to say with a straight face that you're really seriously concerned with class as a problem. I mean, you can't really have it both ways. And Britain slightly tries to.
Shahid, who works at a convenience store on the street, says about these mysterious cards, it gives them an excuse to talk about property process. It's the only time they're ever allowed to talk openly about money, so it's no wonder it gets them excited. Do British people find it hard to talk about money?
Very. And I noticed it particularly because I grew up in Hong Kong, and it's a completely routine conversational icebreaker to ask someone what they do and what they earn. And it's a fantastic icebreaker because the answer is always really interesting. You know, I wish we could go around doing that. You can't in Britain.
You can talk about real estate values.
You can talk about real estate. It usually starts in code. It starts with this sort of terrifying sentence. Oscar Wilde once said the most frightening words in the English language are, "I had a really interesting dream last night." And actually, I think the most frightening words are, "Do you hear what they got for that place down the road?" Because then, you know you're going to be dying on the inside within seconds.
My guess is John Lanchester, whose latest novel is called Capital. The banker Roger seems to be emblematic of the financial rise and fall. He earns a lot of money, but it isn't enough. Does he feel pressure to live the kind of life that he leads with the nannies and the home renovations and the vacation home and the boarding schools and luxury cars and the custom-made gun for the rare hunting outings that he goes on with clients?
I think he does. I mean, that character came to my mind. I fell to brooding on the fact. I heard that there are people, you know, in streets around where we live who, in a good year, this is our area has become full of people who work in finance in the last few years. And I felt a brooding on the fact that, you know, in a good year, some of these guys, their bonus would be £1 million. And that's, you know, I couldn't get my head around that as a number and started to think about what it would be like if you were that person. What, you know, if that were you, what would happen? And it occurred to me that quite quickly you would start to need the money. You know, you would become that person who was actually depending on your £1 million a year bonus. And Rogers was the character who sort of grew out of that seed.
There were a number of articles in the New York Times and elsewhere in 2008 about how the financial crisis was difficult for wealthy people to manage because they rely on making a lot of money to sustain all of their many expenses. For most of the rest of us, it was hard to feel much sympathy for them. Are we meant to feel much sympathy for Roger and his wife, Arabella, who finds every way possible to spend money?
Well, I thought that everyone was – it was a slight concern of mine because I can't dislike my characters while I'm writing them. It doesn't work like that. But I thought that people would dislike Roger very strongly, and it turns out they haven't. And I think mainly because he's weak. You know, he's quite a weak man, and the thing about him is that in a different milieu, he would be a different and probably better person. And I think people slightly identify with that sense of him, that he's not, you know, he's not really master of his own destiny and making his own choices. He's just taken on his colouring from the environment around him.
Well, he likes to think that he'd fit in well in old London. That's a good old days kind of thing.
Yes, and he's one of the, you know, one thing about the city and finance world has an extensive list of vices, but one of its virtues is it actually is meritocratic. Class doesn't count for anything there anymore. And Roger is someone who actually does have that sort of class basis. He would have fit in fine in the old city, and he fits in fine in the new one.
Early in the novel, you introduce what you call the most unpopular woman on Pepys Road, an immigrant, an illegal immigrant. She's from Zimbabwe. In the past, weren't people who came from Commonwealth countries automatically granted legal status in England?
In the distant and happy past, but not anymore. Zimbabwe is a particular case because people from Zimbabwe, the criteria under which you can flee persecution were set in 1948 by the UN, and they're heavily skewed towards particular sorts of ethnic persecution. When it's purely political, it's much harder to get asylum, and lots of people from countries like Zimbabwe end up in the UK. They end up being stateless, which is this horrible, paradoxical modern condition where they have no state at all, and they have they can't claim any benefits beyond a minimum amount, and they're also forbidden from working. And the thing that drives Cantina, my character, nuts is that she has to be busy, so ends up working not so much for the money, so she needs something to do.
Well, she gets a job as a meter maid, although you can get that kind of job even though you're in the country illegally?
If you have fake papers, which she does. And it's a bit like, I think the analogy in New York would be taxi drivers tend to be from the latest wave of immigrants, you know, to the country. And in the UK, traffic wardens, as we call them, because they have the power to write tickets and, crucially, to have cars clamped and towed. That's why everybody really hates them. And they are they're the most recent group of immigrants. And at the moment, in South London, they tend to be from West Africa and South Africa.
But if she had been Polish or Hungarian or some of the other people who've come from Eastern Europe to England, would she have been as despised? Does color play a role in all of this?
I wonder about the traffic warden thing. Traffic wardens do. I mean, it's just on point of fact. In London, they are mainly black.
Well, the reason I ask is I lived in London many years ago when the laws were different. And people would actually put up signs saying colored need not apply for if you were looking for a flat. That's no longer the case, but you have to wonder whether some of those attitudes haven't remained.
I think that some of the other attitudes. I mean, I think it's very, very substantially different. You know, it really has changed as it's changed here. I think, you know, the illegal immigrant is almost more of a flashpoint than race per se. I think that the sense of a society creaking at the seams under the inability to pay its welfare bills and pay, you know, to provide things for, you know, the native population, bitterly resents, increasingly resents immigration, and it's used by politicians. And I think that is the, because, you know, immigrants from, they're fair-skinned immigrants from the former communist countries who are just as bitterly resented. And I think it's a kind of, it's a sort of welfare fecklessness fantasy, largely, that's being drawn on more than it's race, but it is race too.
And there's always been a certain amount of resentment against Pakistanis, for example, now exacerbated by the whole threat of terrorism. We don't want to give away too many plot twists and turns in this book, but two of your characters from Pakistan get caught up in the mysterious "We Want What You Have" campaign, and that makes them more threatening because they're Muslims?
Well, Islamophobia is an issue, curiously, although this book's just come out, there's one slight sense in which it's a historic novel because it's set in 2007-2008. And the bombings we had on our transport system were in 2005. So that was very, very current then. There was a sense that there was that people didn't understand how British-born, British-raised Muslims had become radicalized to the extent that they were willing to go and blow themselves and other people up. And to some extent that has been aired. You know, sunlight is a good disinfectant. There's been an extended national conversation about that, and we aren't quite in the same place we were then. But at that point there was a real sense of paranoia, and, you know, not helped by the rhetoric around the global war on terror, that the distinction really wasn't made sufficiently clear between mainstream Islam and, you know, a few crazies.
You said that you wrote a first draft and then put it in a drawer. Has it changed much since? And did you, with a book like this, do you carefully plot out the story with all these different characters that you have to connect?
I plotted it out very carefully. I spent a long time thinking about what I thought of as the architecture of the book. And maybe partly because of that, it didn't change too much. I sort of cleaned things up a bit. It prevented me from changing it in the sense that, you know, I wasn't then shoveling in all. I think I would have felt a powerful temptation to shovel in all the stuff that I had found out about what was happening in the real world, and it would have been quite difficult to resist the temptation to sermonize or rant at the reader, or even worse, to, you know, explain credit default swaps at them. And I think the, you know, as I say, I think of it as a kind of quarantining thing happened with the nonfiction book.
Well, do you like moving back and forth between fiction and nonfiction?
I do. I mean, I found it very helpful in this instance. It was very, you know, I learned something about the distinction between fiction dwelling on things which are always true. In this instance, I think about obliviousness and about the fact that we never quite realize when enough is enough, and about, you know, not seeing when things have got out of hand. And the nonfiction lets you write about things that are really unlikely.
Well, you've written about nonfiction, you've written fiction, and you've written a memoir, which is something in between for most writers. So
yes,
you've covered the full spectrum.
But as Jonathan Raven says, you know, the Latin verb ficio doesn't mean I make things up. It comes from the verb fingere, which means to shape. It's the word that potters use for shaping a wheel. And, you know, that shaping is essentially the same toolkit from fiction and nonfiction.
John Lanchester's latest novel is called Capital, and it is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much.